Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Today for business owners, hiring can be challenging, especially given the current situation we're all in. Business owner Monica Starks could relate. She needed to hire for a pivotal role at her construction company, GS Group, but was having a tough time finding the right person, especially with so many candidates out there, so she switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience for your job and actively invites them to apply, which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's how Monica found Lamont Jenkins. She said that ZipRecruiter sent Lamont's profile to her around 5 minutes after she posted her job because he was a great match for the role. Through ZipRecruiter, Monica's company has hired everyone from accountants to project managers to field scientists. But Monica's not the only employer who loves ZipRecruiter. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself how ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster and easier. Try it now for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. MURDER, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Beachgoers usually dread riptides and rainy days, but from 1974 to 1983, a different fear gripped the New Jersey shore. Young women were disappearing. Their abductor was Richard Biegenwald, a man released for good behavior after serving 17 years in prison for murder and spending time in a psychiatric facility. Police arrested him on suspicion of rape, and it was not until they connected him to a woman's death in Asbury Park that he finally stopped his rampage. Investigators later linked him to 9 murders and convicted him of 5. Former New Jersey State Trooper John O'Rourke narrates the chilling story of the Jersey Shore Thrill Killer. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Jersey Shore Thrill Killer, Richard Biegenwald, with my special guest, retired New Jersey State Trooper and author John E. O'Rourke. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, John O'Rourke.
Well, thank you, Dan, for having me on.
Thank you so much for bringing us this incredible tale. Let's talk about how you came to be involved with this story and why you felt it. You were compelled to write The Jersey Shore Thrill Killer.
Well, the writing of this story actually has its origins in my first 2 books I started writing, and they were based on the New Jersey State Police troopers that died in the line of duty. And after they came out, I was having lunch with a colleague and mentor of mine, and I had mentioned that, you know, I had the desire to write additional books. The first 2 books were kind of like, wasn't really looking at myself as an author. I just wanted to pay tribute to troopers who died in the line of duty, and a publisher just basically sliced the 2 books into the 1 book into 2. So it was a project that did not even consider myself an author at the time. But I had, you know, doing that and doing the research, I actually had the itch to write more. And I'm a history buff, and I said to him, you know, I want to write about history. And he said, you can't do that. And I was like, well, why not? He says, well, it's hard to break into the true crime a genre, and you did it. You got a publisher, and now you need to stay in that until you get yourself established. So that kind of put me on the path to true crime. I never really looked when I was writing the book of that being true crime, because it was just more of, yeah, it was crime that took a lot of the troopers' lives, but I didn't really. Again, I wasn't thinking in terms of an author at that time. I was kind of green. So it took me a while, and I said, okay, so I need to break into, break in. I got to actually research on what I'm going to do next. So I started looking at serial killers, and my research revealed that every time I would look at a book on serial killers, the name Richard Beaglewood would pop up. Sometimes it would be just a line or two. Other times it would be a paragraph or so, and then several other times it would be a couple pages. So I looked into that and said, okay, he's obviously someone that's always, he's noteworthy, he's been mentioned. Has anyone written about it? And that was the check off. No one had written about it. So I said, okay, I'm going to start researching about Richard Beaglewood and put a narrative manuscript together for that.
Now you take us in the book to December 18th and 1958, and tell me if I'm mispronouncing this. It's Bayonne, New Jersey.
Bayonne, correct, yes.
Bayonne, okay, New Jersey. Upper New York Bay, and one of the notable things is the Bayonne Bridge, ferries transporting people across the waterways into New York, Staten Island, and New Jersey. And this is, of course, Christmas time. In Christmas time in the city of Bayonne, and you talk of the time that America was in. Nassau was just created that year. President Eisenhower was in power. And you profile a person named Stephen Sladowski, a 47-year-old with a wife and four kids. Tell us who Stephen Sladowski is and about his other business other than being a prosecutor.
Well, Stephen Sladowski was a notable member of the city of Bayonne. He was a prosecutor, and he was an attorney in town, and he ended up purchasing a small business in town. So what I tried to do is, when you had mentioned that, when I opened the book and I got the upper New York Bay with the Bayonne Bridge in the background, I kind of, because this story kind of plays out like almost like a movie, so I kind of laid out the narrative kind of so you can put a visual on the environment that was taking place at the time. So you can put in context what it was like in Bayonne at the time and the events that were unfolding when Mr. Sladowski lived there. And so I opened it up. He and his wife, they were getting to the point, he was very successful in town. And they were getting to the point in their life that they were thinking about slowing down a little bit. So they opened up a business thinking that would probably be the family business once he gave up as a prosecutor and started slowing down with his law firm. And it was a pretty successful business that they had. And that was a place that when we first are introduced to Richard Beaglewood, he targets that place. So I kind of place, if you will, a visual, try to painting in words of Sladowski on that side of the river. And then across the Kill of Van Kull, you got this other person. And I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself with your outline. But then I with Richard Beaglewood. So I kind of open it up on that day, what the two are doing in the,
let's talk about Sladowski and his family and this store. And you talked about this being a prominent person and being a prosecutor and a friend. And he's living in a building, and there's a person named Capusta upstairs that's the landlord of this building and has known him for years. So talk about what happens in the store, and then we can introduce Beaglewood and, like you say, a completely different background, to say the least.
Yep. So Stephen Sladowski went about his day. It was coming up on the holiday season, so there was a lot of decorations and a lot of preparation for the upcoming holiday. Spirits were high. Friends were popping in, saying hello, and he was going about his day. And then later on that evening, as they were getting ready to close up, there was only another his business partner, another attorney, was in the store with him, and he did. They were unaware that Richard Biegenwald and his accomplice were outside casing the place. So once the business owner had left, they came in and they robbed the place. However, I think I make it clear in the narrative that it was under the guise of a robbery. I don't know if Richard Biegenwald was actually aware of his emotional motives at that point, but it was more of a killing in mind than an actual robbery. He, I think he had the desire for a killing, and for some reason, Stephen Sladowski was the person that he was going to kill. Some people speculate, although there's no proof to it, that he had once prosecuted a case that Richard Biegenwald was involved in. I had, through my research, I'd found nothing. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It was a long time ago. But for whatever reason, Richard Biegenwald targeted Sladowski as his first victim.
Let's talk about the partnership that does end up in the murder of Sladowski. And you also talk about him being shot in the face and murdered in his store. And then the getaway driver, Jimmy Spornroft. And when they got into the car, there was shots fired back at the store. You also mentioned the idea that it seemed that he left the cash register alone, but took the man's wallet. And so if robbery was the motive, then it seemed to be not really executed, and given that that was the motive for the murder in itself. Tell us about this partnership between Jimmy Spornroft and Biegenwald, how they met, and what were they looking for that evening. Tell us a little bit about their partnership.
Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting part that I came across during my research. I actually was able to reach out and identify James Spornroft, where he was living. I reached out to him, and he was willing to actually get interviewed for the book. So the accounts of that night were taken right from Spornroft himself. Keeping in mind that there are probably some revisionist history on his part, sure, or misremembering on his part. They met. He was a city kid. They were Staten Island kids. They met. It was a small circle of friends in Staten Island. He met. He says he was more of a colleague than a friend, but the narrative and obviously the research indicated that they were a little bit more than colleagues. They were hanging out together on a regular basis. So I think that was James's way of kind of distancing himself to the event that actually took place on that December night. But Biegenwald was a bright kid. He was not large in stature. I think he was about 5'8". And somehow him and Spornroft began hanging out. He was a small, if you look at the illustrations, the pictures in the book, Spornroft was a small, kind of a nerdy-looking kid with thick glasses. However, he was a tough city boy. One picture actually illustrates with the one guy touching his arm, how you could see the anger in Spornroft's face. So they were kind of suited for one another. I think Spornroft was aware of the criminal activity that Biegenwald was wanted to take part in, and his actions prepping for the burglary with acquiring a shotgun, sawing that shotgun, the barrel of it, turning it into a sort of shotgun underneath a bridge in Staten Island. He certainly was aware of what they were about to do. I don't think he was aware that Biegenwald was going to kill the guy. I think he thought they were going to rob the place. So I do think that it was shocking to see that he actually had come out of the store shooting, and he had killed the guy.
Regardless of when you say that he didn't realize it was going to be a murder, you write that he was shocked when Buchenwald showed him the newspaper and then the headlines about murder. And then he said, listen, I didn't do anything. And Buchenwald said, you're in the same boat as me. Now, at that point, though, you would think that maybe he would have his regrets of assisting Buchenwald. But what happens with this partnership? After this near getaway, you talk about shooting up the store. They get away on this ferry. They dump the automobile despite witnesses seeing the car and getting the license plate number and having a description of Buchenwald as well. What do this duo do together, and what do they plan? And what is Spornroff's contribution to it?
Well, following the day, when that incident hits the paper, Spornroff is approached with Buchenwald, and just exactly what you said, he's like, oh, I had nothing to do with this, and Buchenwald is like, no, you're in it just like I'm in it. They, the old saying, it's not what you did that gets you in trouble, although it's what you do about what you did. If he would have maybe turned himself in and said, hey, listen, I drove this guy to the store, and I thought he was going to put back cigarettes. It would have been a pretty weak defense because he helped them, do the shotgun. But if he would have stepped away from it and saying, hey, I had no idea he was going to, shoot the guy, he might have got a lesser sentence. But he chose to flee. They fled to south, traversing the turnpike, and they went into the state of Maryland. And it's in the state of Maryland that this crime spree, if you will, continues. They are observed by a local police officer, Officer Hyman of the Salisbury Police, I believe I'm pronouncing that correct, sees them pulling into town. They committed a minor motor vehicle infraction, but I'm sure it's their reaction to his presence is probably also what stimulated him to stop the motor vehicle. Upon his approach, Buchenwald fired a round at the officer, actually hitting him in the face with the round. Hyman fired six shots back while retreating, but missed all six, and then they fled from there. That's when a police broadcast across the state of Maryland was sent, what we call in law enforcement a BOLO, be on the lookout for, with the description of the vehicle and the two guys. And that's how they get stopped minutes later by a Maryland state trooper, Carol Sermon, I believe is how you pronounce his name. He stops them, and it's a pretty good account on James Spornroff's interview on what actually transpired. He actually said that these two were equally equally crazy. Buchenwald was crazy, and so was the trooper. They were basically doing a shootout, standing face to face with one another. So a shootout ensued, with the trooper getting hit in the leg, and him shooting Buchenwald, hit striking him in the face, but it grazed. But it was enough to send him back inside the car, and causing the car to go into drive, and they ran off into a ditch, and that's when the trooper approached, kicked the gun away, and took both of them under arrest. According to Spornroff, he was just an innocent victim in this shootout. He didn't partake in terms of he didn't have a weapon on, so he didn't shoot. But his account of it was, he was trapped in this Buchenwald world. That's a tongue twister, and he couldn't get out of it. And it was just unfolding before him. So the decisions you make, he was now living by these decisions. But that's how they were actually apprehended after the Soldowski killing.
Yeah, it's incredible, the two troopers' reaction. He grazed the first trooper's face, and so it wasn't fatal, and then went on to, and it's interesting, Trooper Sermon basically recognized that there was that he had seen the suspects and then organized a roadblock, and then there was the shootout between them. What's interesting we didn't talk about is the preparation that these guys did beforehand in terms of something like this happening. And you take the reader right into the horror that this trooper, knowing that these guys are these murder suspects, was coming up to that vehicle. What was the preparation in terms of the shotgun and the jacket that, again, this innocent Jimmy Spornroft claimed? But what did he do in preparation for some kind of confrontation with police?
Well, you're right. I didn't mention that in terms of the prep that they did to for the robbery. And then after, they actually had a bag of shotgun shells. They had the saw that they used to bring the shotgun barrel down to make it sawed off so he can put it on a raincoat, a blue raincoat. And what they did is they sliced in the pocket. They cut the pocket so he can have his hand on the shotgun underneath the long raincoat as he went into the store or when he was walking. And in addition to that, they took Big Wall had reddish hair, and they actually put his hair with almost like shoe polish, made his hair black, running the shoe polish through his hair to make his hair black. So when he couldn't, you know, if they were going to identify him, it would be a person with black hair. And so that kit that they had, that bag that I told you, mentioned, also had a flashlight in there, and it had some other map, and it had some other things. So it was quite clear in terms of, we like to use the word motive, in what Biggenwald's motive was, and Spornroft as well. He, you know, they were prepping this together. They brought the shotgun to a point where you can get it under a raincoat. Spornroft supplied most of the equipment to him. So he was in it. He was in it deep. Whether he knew Biggenwald was going to kill the guy or not, he certainly knew that they were not going in there to get a pack of cigarettes. They were going to rob the place. And when he chose to flee with Biggenwald, he knew Biggenwald. He talked about the anger and the bizarre actions that Biggenwald had when they were sitting one night, just sitting with a girl after they had a bottle of wine, and I mentioned about this in the book as well, to kind of get the reader to understand who Biggenwald was and the environment that he was living at the time, which actually made Biggenwald who he was. Just out of the blue, went off and slapped this woman in the face, causing Spornroft to leave. He says he left because of he was disgusted by it. He was probably also left because he was in fear of Biggenwald. So he got sucked in, and he couldn't get out. At first, he didn't want to get out, and then when he could get out, he just couldn't.
You talked about both of these guys are in Maryland, and they both waive extradition, and they're transported back to New Jersey. Assistant Prosecutor Joseph Oakes is at Bayonne Police Headquarters for these interviews, and from it comes two detailed accounts of what transpired. So they both have something to say about what happened. What's the difference in sort of the tone of their accounts to police?
Oh, well, just like I said, Biggenwald was, was readily, he did. There's a two or three page, if not longer, statement of that night. So he spoke openly about what he did. He was clear on his actions. He was clear on what he was out to do, other than the fact that, falling short of saying that he was out to murder this guy, Soldowski. He implicated Spornroft in all the actions. Conversed that with James Spornroft's account to the prosecutor. He tried to lessen his involvement in it, even though he's the one that supplied the gun, even though he's the one who supplied the raincoat. his defense was he didn't realize that he was going to take it to the next level. He didn't realize that he was going to be the getaway driver, which is kind of thin because, you know, he claims he didn't have a license, but he's the one that actually was behind the steering wheel when Bygone was in the store, and he's also the one that drove away from the scene, and he did it quite well. So he tried to make the least of what he did and try to spawn off in his account. But it was quite clear, and they were very cooperative on how they prepped for the robbery, what they did, where they were, how Big World put on the raincoat, slipped the shotgun, the sort of shotgun underneath the raincoat as he walked into the store, putting on his hat as he walked up the steps, how he slid behind the driver's wheel. So he was cooperative, and they laid it out really well on what they actually did and how that crime unfolded. The interesting thing, I don't know if you have that in your notes, the interesting part of that, I mentioned a young kid. There was a group of kids that actually saw the getaway and Big World come out of the store. And one kid, I think his name was Kevin McLaughlin. Last name is McLaughlin. I don't recall what his first name was. He is the one that held Stephen Slodowski in his arms. He was only 18 years old when he took his last breath. That incident left such an indelible mark on him that he ended up going in, into the priesthood. I met him at one of my book signings a year or so after I wrote the book. So it's a pretty good story. It was the event was impactful, and it didn't just impact the Slodowski family. So,
right. We're going to use this as a pause for a moment for the following commercials. Now, we were talking about Richard Biegenwald, and they've spoken to authorities, and they realize the crimes that these guys committed. Maybe they don't know the motive, but authorities, as you write, look into the life of Richard Biegenwald. And so tell us about his parents, Albert and Sally, and tell our audience about his strange background and life.
Albert and Sally were, you know, class blue-collar workers. They had, you know, Richard Biegenwald. He was born, and from a very early age, he started his behavior. They classified as bizarre. He would be playing on the floor, and then all of a sudden, he'd stop and almost like pretending that he stopped in time, and he wouldn't move. And that behavior continued. As the older he got, the more troubling, if you will, his behavior became, so much so that they brought him to a doctor. And this is the point where my research is kind of, it's kind of all over the place in terms of on the medical diagnosis of what he actually had. There's one account that says he was schizophrenic, which kind of is in line with that bizarre body movement that falls in line with someone who's a schizophrenic. That's part of what they do. As a kid, he was fascinated with fire. It was, which is another a hallmark of this type of individual who's going to go on to be, you know, antisocial disorder. He was fascinated with death of animals, and he was involved doing a couple of those things growing up. And so he was from a very early age, he was in and out of doctor's offices and hospitals because of this behavior. What I wasn't able to determine or discover in my research is what treatment was really afforded to him. There's no evidence that, even though one account has him as a schizophrenic, the other one has a, you know, antisocial disorder, clearly classifying his behavior as bizarre and obviously bordering on troubling, since he said his tried to set his house on fire when he was a small toddler. But in terms of medication, now medication was different back in the 50s, but there was still medication available. I don't see anything where he was actually treated for his clear mental disorder, whatever that would be classified as today. He was, you know, he was in a children's psychiatric hospital in Rockland County for a while. He went to New York Belleville Hospital. He was there. When he was a kid, they would give him electric shock treatment, which is a, it sounds cruel. It really is cruel. But my research indicated that was a common practice. I believe to some extent it is even used today. In trying to treat individuals who have this type of mental disorder, he had recounted that these electric shock treatments, they would, I guess, from either water or sweat or a combination of both, he would be cold in between the treatments, and he recounted that he would used to have to urinate himself to try to keep himself warm. So you clearly there's some problems going on there, and it's exacerbated by the treatment that he was receiving. At one point, when he becomes a teenager, they put him into the state school for boys, which is up in Warwick, New York, which is basically a school for troubled youth. And he was there for a while. And which was unique about Richard Bigwater, and I mentioned it when later on, I guess we'll talk about it, is that he was very intelligent. His defense attorney years later would classify him as brilliant and probably one of the smartest people he had. He said his IQ was extremely high. He had this way to really identify. When he first got into the trouble school for boys, he acted out, actually tried to escape, getting a group of people, and they actually tried to escape. When he realized he wasn't going to get out that way, he became a model student, started complying and understanding Buchenwald and the research that would unfold in this process to write this book. He identified that as, okay, this is how I want to get out of here. This is how I'm going to get out of here. Good behavior, play it up, act a role, and they're going to release me. And they did. And he went into the mainstream school system, where he eventually dropped out. But so that's foreshadowing on what was going to happen years later when he was behind bars.
You're right. He talks about we get back to the trial, because there is no trial, but there's guilty pleas from these guys that have already signed extensive statements of their culpability. June 15th, 1959. So Jimmy gets 25 to 30 years, both eligible for parole. And as you say, Buchenwald doesn't adjust immediately, but at some point, because this, where he is, there's a riot even at the prison. So both of these guys try to mind their own business. Once they go to prison, they're both separated. They don't want to have anything to do with each other, apparently. But they both get the idea, but especially Buchenwald finally gets the idea that maybe if he behaves himself, he'll get out on parole. And he does in 16 years. So now he's a free man, and he's living, as you write, at his mom's in Staten Island, June 24th, 1975. And he gets some work painting houses and helping in automotive shops. He's now more well-read and more mature. He's a really bright guy. And then you talk about he meets someone named Diane. Tell us about this meeting. Who is she? How old is she? And tell us more about this relationship as it progresses.
Diane Buchenwald is an interesting character. She is very attractive. She's a bigger woman, not in height wise. She's probably his height, if not a little bit taller than him, but very attractive. She becomes enthralled by Buchenwald, and understanding what was going to take place with his thrill killings with women, he had a sense about him. I still can't wrap my head around what that was. He was an average looking guy. He had piercing blue eyes and he had reddish hair. But there was something about his persona, his personality, his way to interact that made him very welcoming to the opposite sex. So she became smitten with him, and they began dating. Now, there is some drug use in Buchenwald's life, and she, although there's no evidence that has her doing drugs, but there's no evidence that says that she wasn't, and she was clearly aware of the world that he was now operating in. So I'm sure his lifestyle was somewhat attractive to her as well. But they ended up dating, and they ended up getting married. I use the word bizarre. I don't want to use the word too much, but it's a bizarre relationship. As time goes on, he actually introduces a girlfriend to the relationship. But I don't know where you are with your notes. I don't know if I want to get ahead of that. If you want to talk about what unfolded as soon as he got out of
let's talk about Diane and he meet, and so they're an item. But before you talk about the marriage, we got to talk about how he meets his attorney again, his attorney in a much bigger case, Lou Diamond. The thing is, he's with Diane, and he picks up a hitchhiker on the road. Tell us about what happens to this hitchhiker, and tell us what happens, that circumstances that lead to him meeting his future attorney.
Yes, he picks up a hitchhiker one evening, and she gets into the car. Again, with whatever disposition that he has, that he has this ability to get women to listen to him, to comply, and to feel safe and secure, which is a common trait amongst many serial killers. Unfortunately, that is true. She gets in the car, and they're driving, and she, unlike many, she senses something is starting to go wrong with his behavior, and she follows her instincts, which is commendable for her. She realizes, you know what, there's something wrong here, and she manages to escape. She manages to escape, and she flees, and she goes to the police department, and she gives a description of Richard Buchenwald, which is, you know, 5'8". Red hair, piercing blue eyes. He's got a scar on his face. That's from the gun. That's from the gunfight that he was involved in '58. Not really hard to avoid that description on Buchenwald's part.
Right.
He ends up, based on that description, they identify who he is. He becomes a target. They arrest him. He's sitting in the jail. In Staten Island, there's a criminal defense attorney, a young defense attorney named Lou Diamond. He represents a lot of the, he's a criminal defense attorney. So he represents a lot of the, mobsters on Staten Island.
Right.
So he has a reputation as being a mob attorney. He gets a phone call, he says, from someone in the underworld who he doesn't identify, but he knows, he says it's clearly someone that's in the underworld, obviously, i.e. organized crime. They say, we need you to do us a favor. When they ask to do a favor, you do a favor. We need you to represent this person. He was arrested, and he's a good kid, keeps his mouth shut, just does what he's told. So we need you to represent him. That's how defense attorney Lou Diamond is introduced into Richard Buchenwald's life. He goes to the jail. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. He goes to the jail. for the first meeting with Buchenwald. They're sitting there talking and, you know, going through, you know, the case and what happened. And before they, before he leaves, he closes the door. Diamond looks back and he says to him, "That's an interesting hair color you have." And he walks away. But he did it in such a way, in such a tone, that Buchenwald got exactly what he meant. And he shaved his hair that night, which created a problem in the police lineup the following day. And that's ultimately that ended up leading to him not being identified, because the victim could not identify who he was. He walked on that charge. And back then, and nowadays they do photo lineups. Back then they actually did live lineups of people. Yeah. So.
Yeah. It was interesting, too, that when we talked about the marriage, because he thought he was going away, because he was certain he was going to go away, and he knew nothing about this someone, Angel, in his corner recommending and giving a call to Lou Diamond, this prestigious lawyer, to come and defend him. He thought he was going to go to jail, and so Diane and him tied the knot at that point. So knowing more about his character, she decided to marry him while he was off for prison, potentially.
Correct. And it's kind of, looking back at it, we know now that you know, they were looking that he was going to sexually assault that hitchhiker. Now we look back and sure, we can speculate that it was actually probably going to be one of his thrill killings.
Yeah.
Did she know about this? We don't know. Was it some sexual thing that they were going to take part? So she was aware of his behavior and his criminality. To what extent, you know, we can only speculate.
Right. Now you take us to January 14th, 1983, and there's two boys playing, and they discover a body about 50 feet from the start of a path, just off a trail, near a Burger King adjacent to a wooded lot. And it's skeletal remains of a female in Ocean Township. Detective Robert Miller is involved. And there's also a detective, Lucia. Now, what's the condition of this female? And is there any evidence left behind? And then tell us about Anna Marie Osowicz. I don't know about this pronunciation. Osowicz, I guess.
Osowicz, yep. Yes, these boys discover the skeletal remains of Anna Osowicz. There is some evidence. There's clothing that's there that she was wearing. There are no shoes found at the scene, and there are some 22 bullet fragments in the skull of the victim. That's the forensics that they had at the time. Had no idea. There was no identifying paperwork documents with her. So that's what they went on, is just there was a missing person. And, 22 rounds, fragments were found in the skull with clothing. What happens is it gets reported on the news, it's in the paper, and a police officer named Mike Dowling from Asbury Park Police is reading the paper on his day off, enjoying a cup of coffee, and that's when he comes across this article. And what stands out to him is them didn't have any shoes, and he recalled a missing person case that he had done several months before, that she had been sitting up in the Asbury Park boardwalk, really stone's throw from the famous stone pony where Bruce Springsteen frequented, was sitting there, but she had no shoes. So he, based on that, he reached out to the PD, and that's how they ultimately ended up identifying her as the victim.
You write about the friend and Anna Marie going out, and then her friend has issues, so she has to go to a washroom. So she leaves her friend outside of this, out, like you say, across the street from the Stone Pony, famous musical venue. And when she comes back in so many minutes, Anna Marie is gone. And so that's how she is then reported. Her friend reports her the next day to police. And so how does the investigation proceed, and how far do they get in terms of determining who the perpetrator is in this case?
Well, the police follow normal protocols, and in this case, the last person she was with, she's the first one that's going to show up on their radar, and could she have any involvement in it? And she did have, she had a little bit of a troubling past, but so did Anna in terms of recreational drug use, and so they explored her background, and the one thing that didn't sit well with them was the fact that she had, they walked back. The house that she was using from her uncle wasn't exactly close, but it was in walking distance, and they went back there to use the restroom. She left Anna, and she came back, and that's when she was gone. So they had a little bit of a problem believing that at first. But ultimately, as it turns out, that obviously she was cleared from that. So looking back at this, you can see, as being a former state trooper, you can see there's some really communication errors being dropped on law enforcement's part, because there were missing women that were happening all across the Jersey Shore area. And because of it was different venues, it wasn't really getting reported. So I don't know why no one ever put two and two together and said, maybe we got a serial killer on the loose, because you go from November of 81 to November of 82, you're talking about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like 6 people missing, but they never really put two and two together. So they were still exploring what happened with her, and they weren't tying in. This is the thing that really kind of perplexing for me as an investigator, why they didn't start exploring the missing people that were taking place, and they were all very similar in age and looks as well, young females, dark hair, dark eyes,
right.
But they didn't. So they were, they had a victim. They had some forensics. DNA wasn't what it was, if it existed at all at the time. It was just beginning to come into play.
Yep.
And that's all they had. If not for, I had mentioned Richard Biegelwald introducing a girlfriend into he and Diane's life. If not for that girlfriend coming forward, Richard Biegelwald might never have been arrested. And Anna's murderer would probably not even be identified.
Let's talk about that. You write that detectives Lucia and Miller learned that Anna had been wearing a black and gold ring, and there was no sign of that ring at the crime scene. But that'll be important later. You introduce Teresa Smith, or we should introduce Teresa Smith, who's 22 years old, another very pretty, beautiful woman. She's addicted to amphetamines. She's working as a waitress. That's where she meets Diane Biegelwald. Tell us about the relationship that quickly ensues and what that relationship is characterized by.
Well, yes, she meets Diane. Diane introduces her to her husband. This is where I anecdotally joined that drug connection with Diane. Because she was addicted to amphetamines. So there was some drug distribution going on out there. There's another gentleman, I'm sure we'll talk about, William Ward, who was involved in that drug running. So there was this activity was going on, and that's how she comes into the Biegelwald world. And then at some point, she ends up actually having a sexual relationship with Richard Buchenwald and living together with him and his wife Diane. To what extent the it's pretty bizarre, again, with the sexual activity that was taking place. There was certainly sexual activity that was taking place between Buchenwald and Teresa. The role Diane took in that part, I don't know. But it's bizarre and strange. But there was certainly a sexual relationship. And what he started to develop with Teresa was this, he had this, what would be described by her as a desire, almost like he had PMS, that's how it was described to law enforcement, that he would have to go out, he would get in these moods, and that's when he would go out and he would do his thrill killings. And that was his way of calming down and getting his thrills, if you will. So he would go out and he would target these young, attractive, brunette, dark-haired, girls in their late teens or early 20s. And although there's no proof that he sexually assaulted them, there is some anecdotal evidence that he did I'm getting ahead of myself. So before we do that, he started to introduce and try to groom Teresa to go out with him for these thrill killings. And he was trying to get her to actually kill someone. Go ahead, Sons, if you wanted to say something.
Yeah, well, he was, like you say, he was grooming her. You write of taking her to a shooting range so that she could get comfortable with weapons. He was asking her questions like if she was curious about touching a body. And then he did somehow convince her to at least look for a victim, and one of those victims was a coworker named Betsy Bacon. So he's confident that he's got her as a confidant, and now he's excited that there's somebody else someone he can share with in his thrill killings that he describes to her. She doesn't witness, but he describes to her. So when you talk about no evidence of something like that in terms of no witness, tell us about this potential murder of Betsy Bacon and what actually happens.
Yes, she identifies a victim, and she for some reason she can't go through with it. So she identifies it. He's going to go out and they're going to go out and they're going to do it, and she's going to actually do the killing. She cannot work up the ability to do that. Somehow he decides then what he's going to do. let's back this up a little bit in terms of Anna Osowitz, because what happens is he brings Anna Osowitz. He picks her up at the on the Jersey Shore on the boardwalk. He brings her home to his apartment in Asbury Park. And she's in the car, and she's high. They were smoking pot. He leaves her in the car, and he goes up to the bedroom to wake up Teresa to get her to come down and likely to partake in the killing. She's so high and drugged out that she does not want to go down. She does, however, get up and looks out the window and sees the silhouette of Anna Osowitz in the car. She goes back into a drug-induced sleep. The next morning, he brings her down into the a detached garage where he's got the body of Anna Osowitz, and he wants her to touch the body. And that's where he ultimately takes the ring off of the body. But that right there is the key to his downfall, is because he introduced Anna, and that's how when they ultimately, because now, let's fast forward, she can't go through with these throw killings. She identifies the victim, yes, realizes she doesn't want to go through with it. They ended up breaking up. She leaves. She's no longer a resident in the Buchenwald household. The body of Anna Osowitz is discovered. It hits the local news. She's watching the local news. She sees it. She knows exactly who that victim was. She becomes fearful now because she can tie Buchenwald to that victim. And she knows that Buchenwald is, he's very clean in his killings. He does not allow for loose ends. That's when she becomes fearful that she's going to be the next victim. And by the way, if you look at all the victims that he killed, she fits that profile. Attractive,
yeah.
Dark hair, dark eyes, slim figure. She fit the profile to a T. So, and I think she after she got off the drugs, I think she kind of realized that she was next. And that's how
it's interesting.
That's how it,
it's interesting that you're right, too, that she had, Teresa had, when she broke up, she was dating another man named George Susco. And just as the papers were reporting the discovery of Anna Marie's body, she had told George, but he wrote it off. And then he shared some of those stories with his ex-wife, Bonnie, who was a probation officer, and she didn't believe it either. But finally, she called their friend Detective Bobby Miller. And so, finally, the authorities were aware of Teresa, weren't they?
Yes, and it is strange that what she was describing is Richard Buchenwald, and he had a friend living with them as well. It was a large house that was turned into several small apartments, if you will, and his friend, more of a colleague, Darryl Fitzgerald, lived there, and what they would do is they cut through the floor, so they had like a secret entrance to go down into the basement through the apartment. And in the basement, they were experimenting with a variety of methodologies to kill people. They converted cigarette lighters into .22 caliber guns. One of them actually discharged the night that he was arrested. They had a poisonous snake in the basement that they were extracting the venom from, that they were going to plant on phones at the Monmouth Mall. They had explosive devices. They had weapons. They had edge weapons and a variety of other instruments, including books on how to kill people. So I can see how telling someone about that be like, well, it sounds so weird, and I hate to keep on using the word bizarre, but it's the best word for Buchenwald, to think that this stuff was actually going on. It just seems too far-fetched and almost like she's embellishing. However, she wasn't embellishing. It's exactly what they were doing in their basement. He's a serial killer that's kind of different. I discovered through my research in these thrill killings, that was his serial. He enjoyed doing the serial killing, and that was his way to get excitement in his life, I guess, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
He was identified by his defense attorney as a hitman, and he draws that conclusion by conversations with him and by also his conversations with the figures that actually introduced him to Richard Buchenwald, asking him for the defense, that he really liked to kill people, and he did that, and it was unlike the hitmen that you see in Hollywood movies where they're driving around in Ferraris. It's just he enjoyed that aspect of criminality, of killing. So that operation he had in his basement is almost separate from his thrill killings. That was more, and the poisonous venom from the snakes was more of a mass killing that he was plotting at the Monmouth Mall. It's it's really strange. So I can see how someone would she was embellishing, and keep in mind that she was very high on drugs at the time. She was a drug addict, so her perception wasn't what it should be. So people would probably not believe her.
Absolutely. We're going to going to pause for a moment for this commercial. You talk about Teresa almost not being believed, but she also tells authorities about somebody she says that Buchenwald met in prison, Darren Fitzgerald. So tell us about what happens with the police finding out about the identity of this Darren Fitzgerald.
Well, she comes forward, and she's reluctant to come forward with authorities, but they agree to meet in the Monmouth Mall, in the back of a store, in a clothing area where she's out of view, because she's definitely afraid that she's going to be seen, and she's the next victim of Buchenwald. So this introduction to Bobby Miller takes place in the concealed confines, if you will, of a clothing store.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is very bizarre what she's saying to him. So he brings that information back, and they set up a formal interview on what's there and who's actually in the apartment. So this is the game plan and the takedown, the raid. In that interview process, Darryl Fitzgerald is identified as a colleague, one of the people living there. He's got a violent past. He's been arrested for violence. He's been arrested where he had guns, actually shoulder holsters and stuff, with a bulletproof vest on him in the past. So they know that they got one violent in there, and they also know Buchenwald, that he had been arrested. He was 18 at the time for murder. But his arrest record, other than the hitchhiker account, is pretty much vacant, other than the first killing, because he spent the vast majority of this time in prison. So doing their due diligence, they realize, okay, they're going to have to do a raid, and it's going to have to be in the middle of the night, and they're going to have to, there's a very real possibility that Darryl Fitzgerald is not going to cooperate. So that's how he's introduced into it. And some people describe him as being even worse than Richard Buchenwald, that he was a real badass. But he was a badass. I think he was also intimidated by Richard Buchenwald, because I think Richard Buchenwald was crazy, and he knew he was crazy. So Fitzgerald was almost a sidekick to Richard Buchenwald.
Now, what's the idea for the takedown? They want to minimize any kind of damage to anybody, make sure no one gets hurt, and they understand that Fitzgerald and might have weapons and might be not cooperative, to say the least, and Buchenwald the same, if he's already shot at police before. So what's the idea? What's the strategy? What's their plan? And tell us about that execution of it.
Well, they decide that they're not just going to do a raid where they're going to do a no-knock and go in. They decide that they're going to do a takedown, and they're going to it's Asbury Park this time. It was not the Asbury Park of today. There's a lot of criminal activity taking place in that community.
John, you just broke up in the last... John, you just broke up in the last bit of exchange. We were talking about the plan for the takedown for Buchenwald at the apartment and Fitzgerald.
Okay. As I said, Asbury Park was not the Asbury Park of what it is today. There was a lot of criminal activity taking place, so it would not be unheard of to have a trespasser in the middle of the night. So that's what they set up. They decided that they were going to do a takedown. They were going to have a police officer go into the yard under the guise that he's a criminal trying to break into the car. And they would, police would be spotted, and they would take him down, and they would create a commotion in the parking lot, which is really just the driveway of the apartment. Because remember, the apartment is just basically a large house that was converted into like four apartments. So they were going to create this commotion as if someone was being arrested, hoping that Buchenwald and Fitzgerald would come outside, and that's when they would take him down. And so that's what they set up, and that's how they were able to apprehend Buchenwald. He actually came outside. Fitzgerald did not, and they had to go inside.
Now, they arrest him, and they end up arresting Fitzgerald as well. What happens with the questioning, and what do they determine? Tell us more about what happens next.
Well, an interesting part of when they went inside to look for Fitzgerald is that they didn't find him at first. It took quite some time, is because it goes again with the story that Teresa was talking about with this lab taking place with weaponry and poisonous snakes in the basement and hidden closets and in the house. He was hiding. There was a hidden compartment within the wall behind a mirror. And he was hiding behind that with a gun, long rifle in hand, while they were searching through the house. Why he didn't start firing is a mystery. One of the officers said that they remember staring in that mirror and looking back at it, knowing that he was on the other side because it was a two-way mirror. Looking at him with a long rifle in hand is kind of scary. Probably because he was under the impression that they weren't going to discover him in the closet, and there was a lot of them there. Ultimately, they did, and they apprehended him, and he gave up without any gunfire. During the interview process, post arrest, he was initially uncooperative. Then, when he realized that he was going to be an accomplice in the murder of Anna Osowitz, and they were going to charge him as an accomplice, he came forward. He said, "If I come forward with some bodies, you know, for a plea deal," and that's exactly what happened. And he so that's how they got Darrell Fitzgerald to flip on Buchenwald. And
right.
he had mentioned about where they buried the bodies. And it was several bodies. One or two were in Jersey, and there was two that were at Buchenwald's mother's house in the backyard.
Right.
So then they realized that they had more than just Anna Osowitz as a victim, that there were more victims out there. So then that's when they started to scurry around and start looking at those missing person records and say, okay, who else is missing?
Right. And so that's when they put together and connected him to Betsy Bacon and you list three other women as well that were included with this, that there was evidence to link them to Buchenwald.
Yes, Deborah Osborne, Virginia Clayton, and Maria Shalala, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly. Deborah and Maria were buried in his mother's backyard in a makeshift grave next to the garage.
Yeah. And they found out that his ruse was... We mentioned it before. It was just a simple ruse in terms of he used his charm, but what else was part of the ruse in terms of attract people to come with him?
Was marijuana. He had marijuana, and they were going to go smoke and get high.
Yeah.
Yep, it was that simple. He would identify
now,
him, and then that's how he would get him in.
Now, the authorities have enough evidence. They even find the ring, because they talk about they find the gold ring of Anna's, and so they have that as in terms of crucial evidence. But this Louis Diamond is the guy representing Buchenwald, and you talk about his behavior and his antics. So tell us a little bit about what Lou Diamond does and the kinds of things he does with the media to try to help his client.
Yeah, well, if you recall when I said how I opened up the book, I try to paint this picture in words of, you know, Bayonne during the holiday season, and then, you know, from a distance, you could sit across the Kilbrown Coe, you see Richard Buchenwald. And the reason I did that is because this story is, you know, you have the protagonist, then you have the antagonist, and then you got these characters that are peppered in there that are so unique, and Lou Diamond is one of them. He's this popular defense attorney, criminal defense attorney off of Staten Island, who drives around in a Rolls Royce with the license plate that says acquittal, quitted, yeah. And he dresses in long fur coats with diamond rings. So he's this image that is just so different to the small beach communities where Buchenwald is going to end up ultimately getting tried. And they see him riding up in a Rolls Royce and getting out with his long fur coat and, you know, his fingers are littered with diamond rings. He is a character that really likes the show. He likes the showmanship. He likes the appeal. He likes the press. He's well-spoken. He's well-educated. He's a very nice guy. He's easy to get along with. And he uses that to his advantage to really light up the scene when he drives up to the Monmouth County Courthouse.
You say this as even though this is also at the same time, there's a guy named Al Lair, that's the prosecutor, and his nickname is Hollywood Al. It's not like there isn't other people that understand the importance of being a little bit flamboyant and boisterous.
Correct. And then you look at his counterpart, which is Hollywood Al Lair. And the reason he was called Hollywood Al Lair is because he liked to use the press to his advantage. Anything that his office did, very wisely, by the way, anything that his office did, he would make sure that there was a press release, a press conference, and he would get that word out of the job that they were doing. He liked to be in front of that podium talking to reporters and the press. So now you got these two individuals on both sides of the law are very similar in terms of their sartorial splendor, if you will, the way they like to dress and their flamboyance. And it's just picture this taking place in a primarily a beach community in Monmouth County, New Jersey. And you got this serial killer, which is really putting a fear in everyone in the community. How long has he been operating? How many victims have there been? And then you see, you know, Rolls Royce is driving up with defense attorney, you know, dressed all out. And then in Hollywood Al Lair, it was like right out of a movie scene. And I said to myself, you know, this is playing out like it's fiction. However, it's not. Sadly, it's nonfiction. This is real stuff that's taking place, and people have lost their lives.
This is a big case, and it's a potentially death penalty case, and we'll talk about that and that sort of that issue that is not fixed, that there is a death penalty. We'll talk about that. Diamond is right from the beginning of jury selection is performing and up to all kinds of antics. And you write about the jury too, because this case it would be hard for anybody not to know about this case. You write, tell us a little bit about some of the things they found out about the jury that almost derails this trial.
Well, in jury selection, you know, they try to obviously each side tries to get the jurors to fit their perspective or what they want in terms of obviously, in defense. They're going to want people that are unfamiliar with the case, which is hard to do in this area, especially since it's hitting the news and it seems like they're turning up bodies every other day. And there was one juror that was obviously very familiar with the case and failed to report that. And that obviously could have tainted the way the jury's decision, the verdict.
Now, what is the, you talk about James Fagan, the prosecutor, what is his strategy? How does he portray and plan to portray Buchenwald in this trial? What does he call him? How does he want to portray him versus the depiction by Lou Diamond as just his innocent client?
Well, James Fagan's the assistant prosecutor, and he is at odds with the main prosecutor, Hollywood Al Lehr, because Al Lehr is primarily looking to quickly prosecute the case and move on. Having a serial killer in your community is not something that people really want to have extensive coverage on. So I think there was some probably politics involved in that decision, where James Fagan realized that you got a serial killer here. We have identified a number of victims, and God knows how many other victims exist out there that we haven't identified. So he portrayed him like the cold-blooded killer that he really was. That, and he was just doing this for the pure thrill of it, for the pure thrill of killing. And Diamond, thrust with, okay, you got this guy that you have to represent. You've been with him for a number of years now, and now he turns out that he's a serial killer and he's got a number of deaths. Diamond told me in the interview process that he knew that there was no way he was going to get this guy off, even though that's his. Under his obligation and his oath as a defense attorney is to try to get him off. But he said he knew that he wasn't going to get him off. His job at this point was to try to get the death penalty to go away. He did not want the death penalty for his client, because his client was, believe it or not, deathly afraid. He did not want the death penalty. So that was the struggle taking place, and Al Lehr did not want to take the death penalty off the table. He wanted to move forward with the prosecution and to include the death penalty. Throw in to this mix now is Buchenwald approaches Diamond about if he comes forward with a number of bodies, will that be enough to take the death penalty off the table? There is a little bit of, what's the word I'm looking for? There's a discrepancy with the number of bodies that were presented to the prosecutor. Jimmy Fagan, the assistant prosecutor, remembers that Lou Diamond presented to him that they would come forward with 75 bodies if they would take off the death penalty off the table. Lou Diamond remembers that number at 25. And they're both pretty sure that the number is the number. So whatever that number was, there is a considerable amount of bodies out there that are at the direct result of the hands of Richard Buchenwald. So they present this number to Al Lehr, who turns it down. And this is something that James Fagan says that it just never sat right with him, turning that down. Nor did it sit right with Lou Diamond, who said to me, he said, this is something that never really, to this day, bothers him, is the fact that there could have been closure out there for some number of families, and he just was so set that in his view that the death penalty needed to be enforced with this case, that he wouldn't bend. So those bodies were never presented to the prosecution for the for recovery, and the trial proceeded. Ultimately,
incredible.
Ultimately, he was found guilty, and the death penalty, was instituted. However, during the appeal process, they won that, and he got life in prison without parole. So it was kind of counterproductive for the prosecution. They could have maybe got something, walked away with some other bodies, and some cases closed, and some families healed with at least closure.
Yes, absolutely. What was the official, I know you touched on it, but what was the official, like years later or after, what was the rationale for not accepting this? Was there any other reason other than just maintaining the death penalty? Was there any other reason why they wouldn't accept that or investigate further his claims?
Al Lehr had passed away, so I hadn't gotten a chance to speak with Al Lehr. And on James Fagan's part, out of respect for his boss, he couldn't answer that question for him. You could surmise it was probably politically driven, that they wanted to show that you had this serial killer in the area, and we're going to get the death penalty. Maybe there was some concern with how many victims there were, what that would do to the community. That's all speculation. I couldn't get anyone to tell me definitively why that decision was made.
Yeah. It's interesting, at the trial you write, too, that the lawyer just doing his job there, Lou Diamond, his strategy was to discredit the witnesses like Teresa that went to trial, and discredit them through their use of drugs, and try to attack their character, didn't he?
Exactly. And, there's a popular, saying in police work, method of operation, the AMO. Serial killers will have a certain methodology. Prosecutors have the same, and so do defense attorneys. And that's right out of the playbook. Discredit your witnesses. And that's it. He played it to the T, and that's exactly what he tried to do.
Now, you follow Buchenwald into prison. How does he fare in prison, and what ultimately happens one day there?
What do you mean by what happens one day? I'm not sure where you're going with that.
Well, he dies in prison. He dies in prison in 2008 from cancer and kidney failure.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, that's a familiar environment to Buchenwald. He spent years in Trenton State, so he's back on familiar grounds, and to some extent, I'm sure that had some therapeutic healing for him. These desires that he had that he couldn't control on the outside were forced into compliance. So I'm sure to some extent that provided some mental therapy for him, in terms of at least he was in control his desires that he had he couldn't fulfill. Prison is a tough place to be. You have to exert your authority. You have to exert your presence, and you have to the standard, if you will, on who you are and what behavior you'll accept and what behavior you won't accept. So in order to survive in that environment, he had to let people know who he was. And he was fully capable of doing that. And anyone who knew Richard Buchenwald knew that he was crazy, and he would kill you if he had to. And when he said, "Leave me alone, or I'm going to kill you," it was not an idle threat. But as time went on, and as he grew old behind those steel bars, if you will, he mellowed out. He worked in a workshop, smoked heavily. I actually interviewed a couple prison guards there. He said his cell would be, you know, look like London with the cigarette smoke, and he'd be sitting there. And ultimately, he ended up dying of cancer.
Yeah.
2008.
And you write too. Yeah, and you write that his wife and daughter, as far as you know, never came to visit. Interesting too, in the near the end of the book, you write about that Prosecutor Fagan went to see Buchenwald to see if he would confess. What was his response?
He let Richard Buchenwald. There was two times that they actually went. One time they, because I think HBO had approached them on doing a documentary or a movie on it. And he wanted nothing to do with that. And then when Fagan sat with him and said, "Listen, you're in here. You're in here for life. We can close out some cases. We can give some closure to some families. You can do some good. Can you help us out here?" Wanted nothing to do with it. He would not cooperate. And and that's the mystery with Richard Buchenwald. His method of operation, we know anecdotally on with his thrill killings, but his other killings, we have no idea, because those people that were associated with him wouldn't end up dying. And then we know one person, John Patrone, who was a criminal colleague of his, ended up getting killed by Richard Buchenwald back in 78. And they found his body, and they found his body, but not his head. And they did that in such a way that they couldn't even connect it to him because of their rush to recover the body. It just wasn't done well. But he is responsible for killing John Patrone. So That was Richard Buchenwald. That was the fear that Teresa had, that she was going to disappear, and that was the fear that that eventually Darryl Fitzgerald would have had, that you're going to have to kill Buchenwald or get out of town because he's going to kill you. He doesn't leave any of his any witnesses, if you will.
Absolutely.
Matter of fact, we did. Just one other thing we didn't mention real quick is William Ward. He shot and killed William Ward in front of a few people out in front of his apartment, and no one came forward because he said, "If you come forward, I'm going to kill you." That's the fear that he instilled in people.
Yes, absolutely. He is a very unique killer, to say the least, and certainly fits the bill of the Jersey Shore thrill killer. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about the Jersey Shore thrill killer, Richard Buchenwald. I know that you have other books as well. If you could just tell us about those other books and tell us how we might find out more about the Jersey Shore thrill killer other than going to Amazon.
My latest book is called Mystery, Millions, and Murder in North Jersey. It's about the kidnapping and killing of Exxon International President Sidney Riso. He was killed in 1992 by a husband and wife team, a former cop who retired on a disability and then ultimately ended up plotting and kidnapping Richard Buchenwald, leading to his demise. And then I had written two books prior to the Jersey Shore thrill killer, and they were called Jersey Troopers, Sacrifice at the Altar of Public Service, and New Jersey State Troopers, Remembering the Falling, about the New Jersey State Troopers who died in the line of duty and the cases that the incidents that actually brought to their demise. In terms of the Jersey Shore thrill killer, I have some information on my website about it. I'm actually putting together my research archives that eventually will be posted, so people can actually look at the forms. I got actual written statements from Bayonne and all the other pictures and documents that I have. So I'm actually trying to put together my research documents for all my books, and they'll eventually be attached to my website, which is www.johneorourke.com.
Thank you very much, John O'Rourke, for the Jersey Shore thrill killer, Richard Buchenwald. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, and have a great evening.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. You too.
Good night.